The following is brought to you by Dustin Campbell, Daily Tech News Show, Andy Beach, Nick Wood, and Craig.
Politics, 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 politics.
Hello and welcome everybody to the Politics, Politics, Politics program for Friday, July 16th, 2021. It's your old pal, Justin Robert Young. We got a great show for you today. We're going to update you on where infrastructure is at right now. The Democrats have released their plan for how to get the rest of the infrastructure that they would like into it, the soft infrastructure, as it were. It's got a price tag, and the moderates are already unhappy about it. We will also take a look at the other biggest story of the week, and that is the Texas Democrats flying north for the summer. Indeed, it is a big kerfuffle right here in the city for which I am broadcasting from, Austin, Texas. And I will let you know that while I can appreciate the grandiosity of the gesture, and I very much thank them for the content in this, the content desert, I don't know if it'll be the best for them. And by them, I mean Democrats who actually live in Texas. All that, and a conversation with Matt Donnelly of the Ice Cream Social. He is going to explain to us what Bruce Springsteen means politically, how it has evolved, and then we get into a little bit of comedy talk at the end. It's a good chat. I think you're really, 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 really going to like it. But first. All right. So, as we've mentioned before, we've got two tracks that this infrastructure is running on right now. Both of them are being spearheaded by the Senate. It would then go to the House. We've got the bipartisan deal. And by the time that you hear this on Friday, we might be further along on it. But right now, this is kind of a delicate situation where everybody's actually writing the legislation. So the Republicans are concerned about the pay-fors, whether or not the pay-fors, aka how this would pay for itself, is real, and it's not just going to be something that'll fall apart and create new debt no matter what. As of this recording, it looks okay. If you don't hear screaming and yelling, it means it's good. The real interest, at least right now, is on the Democratic side. Because we finally have a number on what the Democrats want for the rest of the infrastructure. Remember the first part, the bipartisan part, around $1 trillion, maybe a little bit more than $1 trillion. The other side, the soft infrastructure, $3.5 trillion. So more than triple what the bridges, roads, tunnels, and broadband will cost. This is via the Punchbowl newsletter. The internal agreement among Senate Democrats is a critical first step, but it's only that, a first step. Manchin and Sinema, the moderates that you're going to really have to woo over if you are the progressives, only support a much smaller reconciliation package, somewhere around another $1 trillion to $2 trillion. So we'll have to see what they think of a $3.5 trillion framework. Progressives, meanwhile, will not accept a $1 to $2 trillion deal, while Bernie Sanders won agreement to expand Medicare to cover dental, vision, and hearing coverage. He lost the battle to lower eligibility to 60 or even 55. So further caves will be tough to swallow on the progressive side. And that was before Manchin put out his own a statement on this, saying that, you know, this is not going to happen. They said it's too expensive. The more we go with this, the more I do genuinely believe that this bipartisan deal is going to get passed through the House, and then the Democrats are going to fight with each other to the point where they can't agree on anything. Because remember, they need everything. They need everything. Everybody, all hands on deck, all 50 in the Senate to pass anything. So if Manchin and Sinema are not swayed by this, and the progressives are already at maximum reach across the aisle with $3.5 trillion, well, might just be dead in the water. But we'll see. That's early. It's way too early. Way too early to say that. Right now, we just have a fragile moment on the bipartisan, hard, rock-solid, tumescent infrastructure, and the beginning of an internal Democratic conflict for the $3.5 trillion downy, goose-feather-soft infrastructure. Here's the other big story of the week, and it happened in my backyard. Happened. Past tense. It literally left my backyard. Texas Democrats, for the second time, denied Republican-dominated legislature and the Republican governor the ability to pass a new voting bill they deemed voter suppression. Last time they snuck out of the chamber, forcing GOP Governor Greg Abbott to call a special session. On Tuesday, they did it again. This time, they flew to Washington, D.C. and vowed not to return to the state capital of Austin until the current special session ends. Governor Greg Abbott sent Texas police to arrest him, which is an impotent gesture since the police under Abbott's control don't have jurisdiction outside of the Lone Star State. So, the Texas House Democrats will spend the next few weeks in D.C., presumably not eating barbecue. Because it's, I mean, they didn't get Ben's Chili Bowl. That's good in D.C. There's not a lot of good barbecue in D.C. At least not that I've had. Not as good as Austin, at the very least. That would be a great round of emails that I got. TheYoungAmerican@gmail.com if there's a great barbecue scene in D.C. that I'm not aware of. Now, here's where I would have usually gone this round with a segment like this. I would have read this bill, and I'd see if the Democrats were justified in making like brave Sir Robin and bravely running away. And I did read a lot of coverage of it. What I was able to glean is that I still think this bill and its cousins around the country, including the one in Georgia, don't even have much of a chance for honest discussion. Mostly because in none of the press coverage I've read about this is there even a mention of the fact that nationwide, states took emergency measures to expand voting apparatuses for COVID reasons in 2020. Now, you might think that these measures were a long time coming, and it's a total coincidence that your guy won when they were in place. Or that they were a necessary stopgap for health reasons in 2020, but we should return to a new normal. And also, it's a total coincidence that your guy lost when these things were in place. But we should all acknowledge that it did happen because of COVID. And these bills are at least in part a reaction to draw a new normal by way of the legislature that was elected to do so. Whether or not you believe in that legislature or you're in the opposition party of your state, that is why they are elected. Now, believe it or not, in this Texas bill, there was marginal bipartisan compromise, at least compared to the first version that the Dems fled to not pass, specifically on restrictions with Sunday voting, which is viewed as targeting black turnout. And some disability restrictions were amended in the Senate bill that did pass, by the way, after the House Dems bolted. It'll die on the vine if they don't come back before the special session, or at least enough of the House Democrats to make quorum. But here's my big point on this. The House Texas Democrats right now are props. They are big foam cowboy hats for federal Democrats to wear as they raise money and act like they have any leverage to pass a Voting Rights Act in Congress. They don't. They're not going to agree on the second part of this infrastructure. You think that they can get together and sway anybody to do a voting rights bill when this is how they're treating the bills in the states? Hell no. They are making this a federal issue. And they are for sure going to raise a ton of money on this by making it into Jim Crow. But eventually, the National Party will get bored with their Texas toys. And at that point, all these politicians that are up in D.C. right now better hope they've maximized their networking time with party insiders and lobbyists. Because nobody wants to wear a big foam cowboy hat forever. And Abbott is going to keep calling special sessions, and eventually something will get passed. So here's what I don't know. And if you are a Democrat in Texas, which probably means you either live in or in the suburbs of Dallas, Houston, Austin, San Antonio, this is for you. At what cost? Politicians repeatedly leaving their posts is a desperate gambit. You don't really have a lot of moves past that except resigning. If Texas Democrats are indeed gaining power in the metropolitan areas that I just read off, does this show them to be more or less powerful? Furthermore, if you've already said that this bill is so awful that we are going to pull a stunt like this now, when do you stop? And when have you made enough progress that now you'll vote on something even if you don't agree with it? Or at least allow a vote to be taken? Because that's really what this is. No one's asking these Texas House Democrats to vote for this. They can vote against it vociferously and then campaign on it and raise money. But not allowing it to happen, again, it's just a bit of a desperate move. Furthermore, what happens if the Republicans start punishing them by putting popular bills up for votes after they've fled so that they are absent for those as well? Is it worth it to hang these political albatrosses around your neck voluntarily when there's no real smart way for how this is going to end? And you haven't really gained anything except for a lot of fundraising that's probably not even going to go in these politicians' pockets. I guess I don't politically see very clearly what you get out of this. Now, that being said, the press for this was good. People did say the phrase Texas House Democrats a lot. And indeed, for a few days, America's been singing their song.
Robin ran away.
No!
Bravely ran away, away.
I didn't!
When danger reared its ugly head, he bravely turned his tail
no.
and yet brave Sir Robin turned about.
I didn't!
And
gallantly
he chickened out.
Folks, there's only one way that this show continues to roll. You don't hear ads on this show right now. That means that the way that you can support this show is by heading on over to TakePoliticsSeriously.com. Again, TakePoliticsSeriously.com. There you get our Sunday show. That is, or sorry, it comes out midnight on Monday, but it's called our Sunday program because we review all of the Sunday talk shows. We find the narratives that they are going to be pushing and we tell you what to watch for over the next week. I suspect that this week's episode with what we just talked about is gonna be good. You also get our late edition. Despite the fact that this comes out on Friday, it gets recorded before Thursday, which means that if you want to know the latest of what happened. Like, let's say there was a gigantic infrastructure thing that broke on Thursday. That's the podcast I'm going to talk about it on, not this one, because it gets recorded earlier. Head on over there right now. TakePoliticsSeriously.com. The boss, Bruce Springsteen. 2, 3, 4. He's an icon, a musical legend, and somebody that if you grow up either on the East Coast or specifically in the Northeast is particularly inescapable. Although Bruce's journey, much like one of his very well-written songs, is deeper than you might initially think it is. Here to discuss the legacy of Bruce Springsteen is the host of the Ice Cream Social podcast, our friend, Matt Donnelly. Welcome to the show, Matt.
Hey, happy to be here, Justin. Thanks for having me, buddy.
A conversation that me and you have had off podcast is a fascination with the politics of Bruce Springsteen.
Now, yeah. Well, you disparaged him on air is what happened.
Well, and so because I was irate. I look at Bruce like a musical celebrity, maybe right. One of the biggest in American history. And you, being from New Jersey, find that a diabolical insult.
Absolutely.
A diabolical underselling of, like, that's like me walking into the Vatican and being like, nice story. It's a great story. Yeah. There's just a quantum leap of difference that you as a New Jersey native have to Bruce Springsteen.
We owe it to him. I mean, you know, this is a guy who was going to be billed as a New York City singer-songwriter next Dylan type. And so he called his album Greetings from Asbury Park, New Jersey as an F you to his own record contract with Columbia Records.
Yeah.
Just to put New Jersey on the map. Come on.
So that's all right. Receipts. So here, let's start here before we get into anything else. I just need to know from the voice of a zealot.
Yes.
Please tell me about your God. Just for people who grew up in, you know, the West Coast or away from America. What does Bruce Springsteen mean to New Jersey?
I mean, you know, he is a champion of the state that everyone else refers to as the armpit of America.
Yes.
And he's undeniably successful because of it, you know? And so when anybody wants to rail on us or compare us to maybe another state that other people rail on, he's like the first thing you can produce to be like, well, we got this guy and he crushes it. You know, I mean, we also have Buzz Aldrin, you know, I mean,
no,
we have
but,
a couple
yeah,
other.
He didn't write Tunnel of Love. Like,
and that he's actually gone to the map, professionally, like I just told you about his first album. He goes out of the second album. They're like, re-record this with our musicians. He's like, no, I'm going to record it with my Jersey Shore trash musicians because they've been with me since before I had a record contract. And they're like, if you do that, we won't promote the record. And he says, okay. And
cool.
He lets the wild, the innocent, and the East Street Shuffle just fall off everyone's radar. And he wanted to not re-record and that kind of stuff. So his earliest careers where he should have maybe failed.
Yeah.
By being loyal to his friends in Jersey and being all about New Jersey, he held forth. So he did it a long time ago.
So he is a folk hero. And I guess you mentioned sort of in passing, but let's put a hat on it. There is, you cannot explain if you're not from around there, the psychic rivalry that is New York versus New Jersey or being in orbit of New York
yes.
City.
You are definitely just always a stepchild. I mean, when you grow up in New Jersey, you say the word the city and that does not refer to a city in your state.
Yes.
It either means New York City or Philadelphia.
Yeah.
You have imposter syndrome as a state, no matter where you live. There's very few things that you can not, where you, someone can't point and be like, a lot more stuff's happening over there than here.
And it's not far.
Like, it's not far. It's an easy drive, train ride, whatever you want to do. It's a boat ride. It's right there.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, you just constantly, like, even if you go to the famous Jersey Shore, you can see New York City from there. You can see the city in the distance. And it just is there letting you know a lot more stuff is going on than where you are.
And I would imagine that, like, there is this element, especially from what you mentioned right up at the top of the Bruce Springsteen thing, that it's like, well, no, like, this is artificially maintained, because it's not that everybody who's born in the five boroughs, although there are many, make up the reason why New York City has this reputation. It's it's hoarding the rest of the country's talent up to and including New Jersey, and people go there and just claim to be from New York.
Well, that's it. And, like, if you do anything in New Jersey that's worthwhile, people go, are you going to do it in the city?
Yeah.
Are you going to go to New York?
Yeah.
So, like, no, I'm doing it for you right here. Can't we also, like the Jersey Shore, you know, cover bands, can't we also thrive here? Can we also rock here? And the answer is, like, no. Being New Jersey's best blank gets you no attention whatsoever, but being New York's 10th blank gets you a lot of attention. So
I guess, is this kind of the, like, he's the reverse Sinatra, because Sinatra is a New Jersey guy who was never shy about being from Hoboken, but then was very, very, very keen to wrap himself into New York iconography.
Yeah. And let's not leave Count Basie off the hook on this either. Oh, he really did
this
not do
son
enough.
Son of a bitch.
Did not. I mean, he put out a song called Kid from Red Bank and then really just sailed from there. Didn't really come back.
So, all right. So what we're uncovering is decades of musical betrayal before.
Yeah.
Before the folk hero, the and, man, the David to the Goliath stands up and fells the giant.
Yeah, bronze medal to Frankie Valli, silver medal to John Bon Jovi.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, this is really only one guy really doing it right.
I remember the thing that we wound up talking about, this was, it was another interview that we did about the politics of Bruce Springsteen with or just in politics in music and celebrity in general that had the tie-in to the Bruce Springsteen commercial. But when we kind of first went over that, what was really fascinating to me was how there's kind of this, like, a mascotization of politics in general, and nothing makes mascots like music, even more so than acting, because, like, unless you're in a franchise, you don't play the same person every time. Whereas if you're a musical actor,
you can't pony out Tom Hanks and be like, do monologues for everybody who showed up tonight.
Yes.
You know, he can't really go to work in front of a crowd that paid $15,000 for a dinner plate. Right.
Yeah.
You know, it, music is like, you can bring it in the room.
But even from a like, Bruce Springsteen will be making Bruce Springsteen music until the day he dies. And whether or not, if it's all of a sudden Bruce's cover of Jewish folk songs, they're going to sound like Bruce Springsteen song. Like, you know what that will
sound
like.
His last two albums are pretty weird. You're not far off, but his last two albums are really different.
And that's he's gotten so big now that he can literally do anything. But I guess the other thing to just, before we even get into the music or the politics, about Bruce Springsteen that's always amazed me, and I did bring this up in that other interview, is the hold he has on the media, which I think cannot be undersold. That, like, I watched it happen with kids that were my age in journalism school. They just all, like, one day they woke up and they're like, we're sports writers. We love Bruce Springsteen. Who wants to go golfing? Like, it just, it was like pod people. It was crazy. And, like, they never talked. Yeah. They were lunkheads. Like, they had no clue. They had no diversity of music opinion. They just knew they heard Bruce Springsteen, and for whatever reason, especially for people that focus on writing, like, they really, really, really caught into
it. Well, I think there's an attraction there in that. So, like, Dylan, amazing songwriter, but also seems like a sentient being sometimes.
Yeah.
Like, I can't decide to be Bob Dylan.
No.
It seems like Bob Dylan is born Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
Springsteen is a guy who seemed to like figure it out by banging his head against the wall.
So there's a human element to him.
Yeah. You're like, if he can figure out how to write the songs of the people,
yeah,
I can figure out how to write the stories of the people. I can be the Bruce Springsteen of journalism.
Yeah.
There's a sense of like, I can go that way with him.
Which I guess he does just sort of meld that line between like, all right, it's not like, oh, I'm going to listen to a Decemberist song and I'm going to pick out all the lyrics that have 16 letters and look them up so I can be, you know, better or smarter.
Right. It's like, right.
This is, which is far more my, that was my MO when I was a journalism student. but for them, it was like, or just anybody who gets into Bruce, I think that he can write happy, he can write sad, he can write smart, he can write elemental, and oftentimes he does all of them at the same time. And that's what kind of makes him an artist. And also he just keeps touring. Like there's always been a chance to see him.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's hard because he started so young. I mean, he started just, no matter what, I'm gonna go out and play music at like 14, 15 years old. So by the time he was doing his first records, he had been out in front of crowds for like 10 years.
Yeah.
And trying to keep a bar crowds happy.
That's its own
bar crowds. It's thing. Its own.
Yeah.
You know, if you have 10 years of experience of keeping crowds happy before you sit down and actually start recording your albums, you're gonna have a different palette than someone who's going about it maybe philosophically.
Yeah. But let's get into the meat of the music, because this is where I think the politics sort of,
as I said, this is where your listeners are, this is why your listeners are actually listening, is
this
starting
is why we're
now.
Listening. All right. How would you describe, through his early work, what makes him a superstar, the political ethos of Bruce Springsteen, specifically the early work?
You know, I mean, we're really talking about Born in the USA, right?
Sure. Yeah, we can go.
I think that's where it starts. I mean, he's got a couple of hits. You know, I think Hungry Heart's his biggest hit up until that point.
Yeah.
You know, he's always had his own kind of unique kind of cult following for music fans. Hungry Heart puts him on the radio, but it really doesn't. He doesn't become the super duper star that he is until Born in the USA comes out, and it's his first foray into politics. As people who don't listen to the lyrics consider that to be an awesome patriotic song. And people who listen to lyrics go, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
You know? And then Reagan starts campaigning with that song and everyone cheering. And Bruce says, please don't use my music. I don't want to be in politics at all.
Yeah.
And so all of a sudden, that's his first kind of stance, is I'm an entertainer. Leave me out of politics. You know, like the Michael Jordan Republicans buy sneakers to comment that would come back and haunt him later.
Years and years later.
Yeah. Years and years later, because people don't believe in time. And same thing happens here. So until Bruce ever weighs in on politics again, it was like, here's a guy who wanted Reagan to stop using his music so he can just be a rock and roller and stay out of that world, that space.
So Born in the USA comes out. What year? That is 1986. So we are in the middle of the kind of go-go Reagan 80s. We are in the second
earlier, only because Reagan used it campaigning. So I think it might have come out in 84.
The google.com says 86, but I don't know whether or not. But no, that would still be I guess, was it Bush campaigning? So it would be the end of the second term of Reagan. This is going to be a great part of the podcast where both Matt and I are just Googling
this
to
is
find
where
out.
I hope your editing is top notch.
You overestimate me. As long as I can make this funny, then I don't have to edit.
I'm on BruceSpringsteen.net.
Okay.
And it says June 4th, 1984.
84. Okay.
Yeah.
So then that means it is hot on the radio.
Yes.
As Reagan is campaigning for his second term. And that's where the connection comes in.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, whether or not people think that it is a Yay America record, there is certainly an element that it is a common man's record, right? And that is I think emblematic of his writing, is that no matter what, this is Union Hall, like maybe the son of the guys who hung out in the Union Hall kind of record.
Yeah, well, he famously meets the author of Born on the 4th of July at the Sunset Marquee, and Bruce is, you know, never done anything overtly charitable until he starts doing fundraisers for veterans of Vietnam before he records this album or this album comes out, you know. And so it is his first time really reaching out to maybe a sect of people directly,
yeah,
through effort that he didn't gain naturally by playing music all over the place, you know.
So and this is kind of what makes him a fascinating figure, because he does have all these different ties. Although he does, for whatever reason, speak to an element of, you know, college educated writers, he is, I think, no matter what, there because he is trading off the idea of what I would imagine to be a Reagan Democrat, somebody that was by and large a Democratic voter, that was a union guy or a working class guy that for whatever reason saw worth in the Reagan presidency. They enjoyed the economy doing well. Their lives were better under the Reagan economy. And so it almost makes sense why Reagan is using this song as a rallying cry. But like you mentioned, immediately, not only outwardly is Bruce very not comfortable with that, but I think it sows the seeds for our second act, which is Bruce's actual politics sort of coming more to the fore as he becomes more famous.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And just kind of established where he is. I mean, I don't know how far you want to jump ahead, but I think a real changing point is the song 41 Shots.
Okay. And so that, before we get to that, is there anything, I don't want to miss anything, because this is our deep dive. So if we miss it, then it goes away forever. Well, is there anything between now and between Born in the USA and 48 Shots that we want to deal with?
Not too much. I mean, you know, like basically he comes back up. He basically goes through a period where everyone thinks he's done in the early 90s.
Yeah.
And he has a couple of albums that come out that, you know, mixed reactions, solo albums, Free of the E Street Band. And then he
is this
comes
a period
back with,
where he starts working with, is it his new wife or girlfriend? Right.
So Tunnel of Love comes out. And it's all about his divorce and remarrying Patty. And then it's also the last E Street Band album. And then, so he becomes kind of he loses a lot of his own fans by saying, I'm done working with E Street Band and we're over. And he comes back with a solo band. He plugs in on MTV Unplugged. He has a weird goatee. There's just a lot of things where we cool to Bruce in the 90s.
Yeah.
And then he recovers with coming up with, again, weird looping tracks, Streets of Philadelphia, comes out with the whole thing. And all of a sudden he's out and part of the AIDS awareness campaign. And he's friends with Bono and all these other things. And so he's back on this kind of, so he basically reemerges with a political leaning on AIDS awareness.
And
in
I
the
guess
90s.
That is a fascinating thing. That late or mid 80s to mid 90s, really even late 90s period. And you could probably go from like Live Aid to like the Free Tibet concerts.
Yeah.
That it was like, this was just a period in which musicians were like, I've got a cause. I've got musician friends. We're going to book a massive show. Festivals were huge at that time. Lollapalooza was like a cultural phenomenon.
Yes.
All the subsidiaries of that for these different genres of music were massive, and some still going.
You couldn't tour in the summer unless you were part of a larger tour.
Yeah. I mean, it was, for the non-political stuff, it was, you know, Lollapalooza, Horde Tour, Warp Tour, Lilith Fair. Like, there was just whatever your genre, there was a touring act for you. Oddly, not rap. I feel like that's got a political and racial component that we have yet to explore. But then you also have these, like, Live Aid, again, is so big that it closes the Queen biopic. Like, it is this massive, massive thing. And even though I would love to see somebody do a Free Tibet concert now, considering how much we're tied into China, that to me is pretty much the last time that, like, it fades past that. Like, musicians find different ways that they can channel their philanthropy.
Yes. Although I was at that concert at Randall's Island, and it was incredible.
I mean, yeah.
When you can see U2, Tribe Called Quest, Radiohead, like it was an unbelievable lineup of bands.
To me, nothing shows you how like the effect of the intersection of commerce in China and America more than the fact that like if a major artist, if Selena Gomez or somebody, if somebody was like, I really think we should free Tibet, you would never hear of Selena Gomez ever again. Like that would just be, let alone I'm going to do a concert and it's going to be, I'm going to get so many different people and I'm just the worst rapping Beastie Boys. I love the Beastie Boys. Please don't email me.
Yes.
Like, and that's my big thing. And that's why we're doing this concert. Like, it is fascinating, but Bruce is a part of this. Bruce is a part of, because Bono's got a very political thing, and now he's, and Elton John obviously was leading the charge with AIDS awareness.
Yeah. And it's like where we can like, we feel basically like the song is good enough and it's part of a huge, it's attached to a movie that's creating a lot of waves and it's such a good cause that we feel bad kicking Bruce Springsteen at that point.
So even for hardcore Bruce fans, he's still in the desert a little bit. Like it's still a bop. Like we're all feeling, we all just found out about AIDS like 5 minutes ago. It's really screwed up. Like we just watched this Real World season and he stuck his finger in the peanut butter and everybody's like, Jesus, I didn't know this was a thing. He's dead. Oh my God. That's crazy. And so like Bruce, whatever. That's fine.
I'm really glad that we gave your listeners a companion piece of an AIDS awareness deep dive right along with Bruce Springsteen.
I mean, yeah, like honestly, that's for me. At that age, that was that and Magic Johnson, you can pretty much like put all that in a blender. And it was like, I had no idea what AIDS was. I knew everything about AIDS in about 2.5 months.
I had the episode of 21 Jump Street where Johnny Depp winces at sharing the milk with the guy who has AIDS in high school. And it's a big moment on that episode.
Big moment. The AIDS milk is big in 21 AIDS Jump milk. Street. I don't know. Yeah, I wasn't really a 21 Jump Street guy. I don't think my mom let me watch it.
Oh man, anything Peter DeLuise, I was all over it.
All right. So he's in the charity phase. He's in the charity phase.
End of the 90s, reunites with the E Street Band.
Okay.
Releases greatest hits albums, puts out 4 new tracks with E Street on it, and they tour and they just sell out stadiums everywhere.
So that is when he becomes like a stadium act,
Born in the USA became a stadium act, and then all of a sudden you're like, hey, if you missed stadium act Bruce Springsteen and you thought it was never coming back, it's back. So it's like feverish that he's back, because Tunnel of Love, he actually wouldn't play stadiums. He'd only play like big theater environments and stuff for that album.
Yeah.
And so it was like just over. And then it was just, you know, it was cool if he popped up in a bar, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden he's touring again and he's, you know, he's selling out everywhere, and Jersey specifically, like sells out 5 concerts in a second in Giant Stadium. They add 5 more shows, that sells out in 10 minutes. He adds 5 more shows, that sells out in 45 minutes. He plays 20 shows in Giant Stadium in a row in Jersey that summer. So it's crazy.
Gigantic. Now, before we get to what I think you very correctly have pointed out to be the kind of dividing line on Bruce's politics.
Yeah.
Let's just define for people, so we are all working from the same definition. Yeah. When we say working class people, who are we defining with this? Like, what are the jobs of working class people?
Oh, it's a tough call, because like basically, you know, like the New Jersey landscape changes so significantly from the 70s through the 90s.
Okay.
I mean, you know, it was between Newark and Trenton and all these other places, it was a factory town.
Yeah.
You know, up and down. And then all those factories close. And then all those real estates are bought up by suburbanites who are basic commuting to Philadelphia or New York. But they make up New Jersey and they carry that deal, you know? So the working class, for who's like, I mean, it's a tough call because, you know, I've seen Springsteen live a few times. It's expensive to see him.
Well, now, yes. Yeah. And probably even in the late 90s.
In the late 90s, it was expensive to see him, but it was, you know, really, it's so, you know, I mean, the knock on it is that he never was a working class person. He
sure.
was a musician. And whether he actually appealed to working class people or people who like to romanticize the working class of the United States.
Gotcha. Here's all I would say. If we're going to define whether or not you are fetishizing and wearing them as wearing yeah. their pelts as to signify your own earthy aroma or yeah. like this is who you are. Working class to me would be any kind of manual factory worker. Most anybody with a union in which they are negotiating for like lower scale pay. And that is what you are a part of. So maybe not the pilots, yeah. you know, but certainly a lot of other, you know, big, you know, not baseball players and pilots, but more auto workers, factory workers, like stuff like that.
Yeah.
People making around the minimum wage in whatever kind of service industry. And that's something where like it does get big in Jersey around that time is
yeah.
the casino and entertainment industry that winds up bubbling up there. And then, and here's where we're going to lead into this dividing line. Firefighters and cops.
Yes. Yeah.
Like, and yeah, yeah. and so now we get into his, you know, he has two songs in this late 90s, early 2000s period. One that is kind of the song that everybody needs to hear in the moment, which is The Rising about 9/11. And that is a huge thing. But then he's got this political one about the shooting of
Diallo,
Amadou Diallo.
Yeah.
So that,
and it's not subtly named.
No, it's named the amount of shots that killed him.
Yeah,
it is. Kids, if you're new to this police brutality conversation, ask your parents. But yeah, there was a man in New York City that they thought he had a gun. This was the police explanation. They
yeah.
all emptied their clips. And so that added up to a gigantic amount of shots. It was 48 shots, which is hence the name of the song.
41, yeah.
41,
yeah.
sorry.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, and then all of a sudden, you know, even when he told Reagan not to use that song or when he put out Streets of Philadelphia, nobody was like, Bruce, stop it.
Yeah.
There's no giant voice that was like, don't do it. How dare you? You know,
I think if anything, there was an element of the conservative crowd that was like, sure. Like yeah. if the point is you don't want to be a part of politics, fine. As long as we don't yeah. have to listen to the everyone in Fleetwood Mac tell us how to vote.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so all of a sudden there's an uproar and then it's the New York Police Department. You know, he's doing concerts in New York and the New York Police Department says, we're not going to do security at any of your shows.
Yeah.
And when that police department speaks, it tends to speak for more police departments. Right.
It's the LA one might be bigger, but it is probably yeah. the most influential one in the country.
Definitely influential. Certainly yeah. has a lot of sway in New York. You just spend a lot of time in New York. Mm-hmm. And so then it becomes cops and firemen. No more Bruce. Screw Bruce.
Yeah.
No, thank you. And we're not going to shows anymore. And we're now going to work security. And it's common knowledge is that many security, especially large security outfits are often off-duty police cops. Officers.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it's a big deal that he loses those people.
And so here's what's fascinating to me is that Bruce at that point goes from kind of a transcendent figure, somebody yeah. that I like could play, you know, Alabama the same way he could play the Bay Area. Like he's doing yeah. the same songs. People are there for a lot of the same reasons. They are identifying with these same themes. And then he just kind of becomes a musician who speaks about politics and yeah. that's going to come along with it, whatever culture war costs that are going to come along with it.
Yeah. And from that time forward, you really can look at like his tour dates and stuff in the United States. I mean, still incredibly popular in Europe and stuff like that, but you see, he starts playing like the South,
yep.
less and less. And different areas of, you know, there's just certain areas of countries that start to fade away, you know. And then, so by the time he actually starts coming out and campaigning blatantly
for
Obama. For politicians. I think he already understands that his fate is sowed.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any risk on his part by the time he's coming out for Obama. I don't think there's any risk on his part.
No, because he can sell out the arenas for sports writers alone. You know, there's just enough of them.
Exactly
he's,
right.
he's made critical mass.
And we that engine is proof of concept is happening right now.
Oh, really?
He can just show up in New York every night.
Oh, yeah.
And sell out every night.
This Broadway
the most
thing.
Expensive. Yeah, yeah he's on Broadway right now. And you weren't able to get a ticket before. And then after the pandemic, you still can't get a ticket now. It is the most expensive ticket in
now,
town.
Now Obama can't get a ticket. Like
it's really true.
It's all like hedge fund managers and their girlfriends. And, yeah. and then he'll come back with his wife tomorrow. Like yes. That's it's just, can you afford to pay $30,000 a seat? If yeah. so... cool. Then there's enough of those people that it will, there will nary be an open seat for the next 5 years.
And is the end in sight? No,
no,
there's no end in sight as to when he can't sell out a Broadway theater in New York City. And so he literally proved that he can go nowhere and make a ton of money.
Yes.
Doing live shows.
And he can, and he can do it without the E Street Band. He can literally yes. do it with one guitar and just, and everyone will talk about how amazing it is. And it probably yeah. is. I'm sure it rules. He's a very charismatic guy. His songs are awesome. Like he's, yeah. I don't want to disparage Bruce. But this comes into the final act, and that is that Super Bowl commercial, because there is an element yeah. of I get from conservatives the idea that, look, whatever, Obama was somebody I disagreed with, but that is what it is. There's been a lot of politicians that I disagree with. What got them more than anything was the idea that everybody was happy. This is great.
Yeah.
He's awesome. If you're fair and nice, then you believe that everything that's going on right now is super cool. And if you don't, then you are subject to ridicule. It's like there's now no longer even the space of like, I don't know, I like lower taxes. Like now that's out the window, right?
Right.
And so it's like it's reclaiming this idea of no, moderate is now Democrat. Like, and if yes. you are not a Democrat, then you're not a moderate. And if you're not, and now I'm not getting to the progressive stuff. So the progressives don't email me on what is and isn't whatever. Like I'm just, yeah, I'm yeah. saying
for the Obama era
thing. Yeah. So for the Obama era thing. And that's something that I think when I watched that Super Bowl commercial where it was very post-partisan Bruce, and he's in a Jeep and he's going to a farmhouse church and he's talking about how we just need to get back together and blah, blah, blah. Like,
yeah.
That's one of those elements that I think for some is like, no, that's exactly the problem with like liberal smugness is that like, we like, this is the center of the road. What I can see, what I'm comfortable with.
Yeah, that no one agrees on even the middle anymore.
No.
And I think that's where it's a huge failure for a couple of reasons. I don't know any Bruce fan who's like, yes, what a great Jeep commercial.
I guess there's also the fact that we are assigning. I am assigning yeah. a lot of narrative weight to a thing that is designed to push Jeeps.
An example of what you're talking about being successful was Eminem did it for Detroit.
Yeah.
Right. Eminem did a random Super Bowl commercial. He never weighed in on politics. Certainly wasn't an easy interview.
No.
And all of a sudden, he's saying so wholeheartedly, Detroit needs to come back. American cars, let's do this. And everybody was like, wow, that was pretty powerful
because
for Eminem.
Because that's a thing where, like, who's going to boo Detroit aside from, like, you know, Chicago and Green Bay?
If Bruce had actually done what he wanted to do back in the 80s with Reagan.
Yeah.
And became a reclusive rock star who wasn't always available to the press, who hadn't done a halftime show.
Yeah.
Who then didn't all didn't turn around and do Saturday Night Live, didn't turn around and do all of these things that he used to not do. And he used to never do these big promotional things. And he wanted to stay relevant. So he started doing all the things he wouldn't do to promote albums. And then also weighed in politically very often.
Yeah.
But in his mind, I think he was still that guy who told Reagan to stop using his song in politics. And so if he really was stayed that guy, and all of a sudden out of nowhere was this Bruce Springsteen out of nowhere saying, let's be nice to each other.
Yeah.
I think it would have been very successful, but he was already a political figure at that point.
You can't go back and say like we're all harmonious and everyone's happy right now. And I'm the one who's telling hey, everybody cool out, be friends.
It might as well have been Nancy Pelosi for Jeep.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like it might have well.
When I'm driving a Jeep, I know.
There's a church in Kansas. Yeah.
Did you listen to the podcast with Obama, the Obama podcast with Bruce?
I listened to a few of them. I was listening to his book, so I was kind of saving that for a little.
How was it? I still haven't listened to it.
They're pretty good, you know. Obama's a really well spoken person,
as it turns out.
Yeah, and so it's really fascinating, and a lot of it's about his friendship with Clarence Clemons, and so they get a lot of good stories out of Bruce for that. I mean, that's the thing about Bruce is not always the greatest interview. He's a fine storyteller, but he's not, he's not a good shoot the guy. And so Obama carries a lot of the weight on those podcasts. And also it's important to point out that because Springsteen is an emotional figure, more than he weighed into politics or became like a lib or a figure of the left, he fell in love with Obama,
Yeah.
He fell in love with another generational superstar.
Which is understandable. I mean, they're... Yeah. So I'm researching this thing we're going to do in a couple of weeks on the show about Dana Carvey's worth as a political performer, as a political comedic performer.
Oh, right.
And so I was just doing a lot of research on the writing staff on SNL because I wanted to make sure I got all the credits right for the stuff that he did. And Jim Downey, who was the head writer there forever and I think still writes there, it gets a lot of credit for being a conservative counterweight in certain elements of it. Although he doesn't say that he's a conservative. He was probably the biggest reason why they never really went after or just did anything with Obama. Like Obama was this thing that I feel like is even getting lost now as we move further away from 2008, that people just need to understand. He was this paralyzing cultural force that it even in terms of the conservative movement, because remember they ran John McCain and the conservative movement wasn't exactly in love with him, that was soul searching on the conservative side questioning what are we going to do with this? This is something that was just totally blindsided them a lot in a lot of the same way that Trump blindsided, the Democrats, and they took a while to figure out what the hell they were going to do.
Yeah. In many different ways, untouchable in different ways, right?
Trump was the exact opposite. He was please touch me. He was asking, can you please do crappy sketches about me? It would make so mad.
It's like the unstoppable force versus the untouchable object is really what it is.
Yes.
Obama is the first black president as a charismatic and charming figure. To go after him in any way personally, you that can backfire. Trump was you could unload every barrel you had, and it was ting 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 ting. Nothing
didn't matter.
Stops the march forward on this guy.
He'll bump and feed for you. He'll be oh, terrible impression, and I'll get you next time.
Exactly. Welcome all comers for sure. Yeah. Yeah. So those are two very, two people that will define the era. I mean, in the history books for centuries, it will be the Obama Trump political era.
Well, easily one of the most comedically fallow periods for political comedy, just horrendous. And I feel like,
I got
things
a lot of
are happening. Things are coming back. I hope nature is healing.
No, I mean, I got the most flack I got as a podcaster weighing in on politics who doesn't do political podcasts.
You guys don't really do that on ICS, at least in any kind of main thematic way.
No. I said, all of your comedy podcasts will get better if Biden is elected president. That's what I told him. I said, if you don't want to vote because all politics are the same, or I've never voted in an election, or whatever you want to do, honestly, like, the best thing you could do for the podcast you listen to is vote for Joe Biden. And that got me a huge amount of flack.
Really?
which means that I really did push some buttons.
Oh, number one, you're totally right. And also, I would add as a postscript, you're going to find out who the hacks are. You're gonna find out who was just feeding you like MSG to like keep you coming back to cover up for the fact that they weren't good.
Yeah, I wanted comedy to go back to the merits. You know what I mean? You know,
Jokes and characters and funny things, and not just like crap, I have this awful joke. Let me just staple Tiny Hands or Cheeto to it and see if it's good. Oh no, I don't have a good joke. Let me just bring back like a beach t-shirt store era homophobia, but I can do it if I staple Trump next to it. Now it's back in a big way.
Cause you need stories that are not political. You need non-political mainstream stories.
Well, like I also just think that Biden is somebody that and I don't want to eat too much into the Dana Carvey thing I'm going to do, but Biden is make funnable. In a way that Obama wasn't, and Trump, for whatever reason, Trump was a gigantic target, but nobody could really get a funny take on him because they were so pissed off about him and they just needed to attack him.
Yeah. I can make fun of Biden. I voted for Biden. I can make fun of Biden. No problem. I can watch him make fun of Biden and laugh my ass off. It does not feel like I'm failing my side of the political spectrum by doing so. Right. And anyone who makes fun of him isn't this right wing crazy
lunatic. Yeah, exactly. Right. You can and you could even get incisive. You can say he has dementia. You could say he's slow or he's gonna die tomorrow. And it's like, if the joke is funny enough, they're not disqualifiable. We're not gonna be like,
where did that come from? Oh, you're buying into
the hell?
Tucker.
What's your point?
You're buying into Tucker Carlson about his age.
Exactly.
No, you know, he's a flawed regular politician. And so it's just nice to have politics go back to that era, that area again. It's a nice exhale.
Well, much like Bruce, we probably went on too long, so we will get out of here now. Matt Donnelly is the host of the Ice Cream Social podcast. If you're not listening to it, you're very stupid. And we will have you and the rest of the ICS crew on in the next couple of weeks because I'll be out in Vegas. And I do want to do a big wrap-up episode from our bookmark of when things had just shut down versus now when things are cranking. Yeah. Right? There's no restrictions in Vegas right now, right?
None. But man, it still feels like things are still changing week to week in so many ways. But yeah, it's different. Yeah.
Well, I'll be out there to see for myself in the next couple of weeks. But I will see you then. Matt Donnelly, thank you, thank you, thank you so much.
Thank you guys. Bruce.
Politics, Politics, Politics is written and hosted by me, Justin Robert Young, for Dog and Pony Show Audio in Austin, Texas. The show is edited by Brett Stewart. You can go say thank you to Matt Donnelly for coming on the show by going to px3guest.com. Our email is theyoungamerican@gmail.com. Our Twitter is px3tweets. Our Twitch is px3live. Our newsletter is px3newsletter.com. And you can share our podcast at px3podcast.com. If you'd like a shirt or a mask or anything else with any of our logos on it, you can head on over to politicsmerch.com. You can also support us with a one-time payment, paypal.me/payjury. Venmo is justin-young-20. Our Cash App is PX3Cash, and checks can be sent to P.O. Box 153184, Austin, Texas, 78715. Again, that is P.O. Box 153184, Austin, Texas, 78715. By the way, the existential debate rages on whether or not Venmo money is real. Michael sent me $2 and said, the money Venmo gives you for nothing isn't real. Well, if you want to debate him and you want to see whether or not the fantasy numbers that are in an app on your phone is indeed real money, well, put it to the test. Send me a dollar. Justin-Young-20 on Venmo. Of course, if you want that bonus content, baby, you can only get it at TakePoliticsSeriously.com. Our $3 tier gets you two bonus podcasts per week covering all the news that we miss on our free podcast schedule. And our $10 tier gets your name read at the end of the podcast like these fine folks in the Titanic. $10 tier. Headphones Neil, Dr. G, The Other Half of Whiskey Wednesday, Idris, The Government Unfiltered Podcast, 100 Mile Runner, Berkeley, Stephen, Kathy, Mac, Zombie Doc, D. Really? Methuselah Honeythuckle, The Jen, Middle Age Mike, .com Junkie, Calamity's Abdi, Laser Lord, Scale, De Quince, and Nile the Third, and Gloria Young for King of the New World Order, Utah Jimmy Montana, Chad, David, Snuffies, Off Route 44, Charles, Olin, and Angela, DL, Miranda Janelle, persons familiar with the matter, Robert, Casey, Paul, the most conscientious nonpartisan listeners, Brad, Will, Frozen Summers, J. Pink, and Andrew. If you would like to join their ranks, TakePoliticsSeriously.com. That breaks it out for the weekend, baby. Cut loose. It's hot outside. Find a pool. Find a beach. Crack a claw and recharge. We'll be back at you first thing on Monday morning with our Sunday edition for patrons. Next week, we got some great guests coming up. It's going to be a real fun time. Till then, this is your old pal Justin Robert Young saying, some shows talk about politics, others talk about politics, and still more discuss politics. But this is the only show that dares to discuss.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.
Dog and Pony Show Audio.